is another argument we've been having. Okay.
I wouldn't listen to us for an hour. No. And I like us. I am looking it up now.
Welcome back, everybody.
Yay! Welcome back, HM. Welcome back, Andrew.
Welcome back, Tanya. Welcome back, HM.
Ottawa Theatre Confidential is back and better than ever. After a brief summer hiatus.
We all did lots of stuff.
Yeah, we did stuff.
We all did stuff. We did stuff separately for the most part. So yes, yeah. It's nice to be all in the same room, snuggled on this tiny little couch, as we like to do.
That's why we all take showers before.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's I'm getting my hair cut today because my bangs are starting to defy gravity.
But it's super cute. Yeah. If you could see Tanya's bangs right now, you would know they are cute. The humidity is making her cute. All right, so on today's episode, we have the distinct pleasure of tackling the new theater season as it has begun here in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of shows. There are a couple of shows that we've all seen. The 39th, the Gladstone.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be finishing up long before anybody has a chance to hear this.
True.
Today being the last day, 7:30 productions back out in effect, opening the new special fall season to start for the Gladstone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And of course, Amelia, the girl who wants to fly, the first offering from the new GCTC season. Variety is the soul of pleasure. That's what they tell us.
That's what the program. That's what the program and all the promotional materials say.
So. You guys want to start with the 39 steps?
Yeah, let's gloss over these briefly. The thing about the 39 steps is it is definitely, I'm not hallucinating now because this has happened, more people outside of the normal theater going community are saying things about it than of any other show. Even the Turn of the Screw, which was, you get those shows that are popular across the board and people talk about them that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be talking about them, and this is one. So they've done something right just by programming it.
That will tie in very lovely to a theme that I want to discuss today on the podcast, how economic downturns can drive great sense of nostalgia in the public, and how historical shows are one way of thinking about when days of yore were better.
Oh, yes. That's interesting.
Yeah,
that's a good point. That you get the retreat into the past or the reach towards futurism to avoid an unfortunate present.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Ah, it's a thesis statement. Cool.
I started off on my intellectual footing.
Do we have time for a thesis statement? The timing effect is because I'm actually intending to see the 39 steps again today. So.
Yeah, which starts at 2, so Andrew has to be at a show at 2, and I have to be at a salon at 2, and Heather Marie will likely kick us out well before that, so.
Bonus feature of the Ottawa Theatre Confidential podcast is that you get to hear as much about our lives as you would if you followed us all on Twitter. Possibly more.
Yeah. But no, seriously, 39 Steps, it's true. I've heard a lot more people who are not regular theatre goers going to see that, and I think that, you know, if you look at everything that's sort of coming out through film, we see it here in theater, that there's this push towards, tell me more about history. Let's look back at the past. Let's sort of, you know, see when things were, you know, more carefree and everything, which is funny considering the era that 39 Steps comes from was not economically favorable in and of itself, but that there's, you know,
That's where the best comedy comes from. I don't know much about the time in which the original. I mean, this is an adaptation of an adaptation of an adaptation.
Kind of like Hairspray, right?
That's a little obscure, but sure. But not that Hairspray is obscure. But I mean, I don't know about the climate in which it was originally written. But when the film came out, that was just pre-war. Just pre-war, so which was a depressed period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that evolves the best comedy, right?
Yeah.
Is depressed periods of time, you get the best comedy. Look at Spent.
Yeah.
That came out. Economic depression just drives comedy and clown and stuff like that.
It's great when you put characters... This got,
redone in the 50s in England? That's where this current adaptation comes from, the 50s or 60s? And everything post-war in England is pretty much the same long economic depression. Mm-hmm. So...
Well, it's amazing, like, when you put characters in a situation where they truly have nothing to lose, it makes for interesting entertainment, and they can do so much more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's...
The specifics of the show, I felt, was really, really... it had a sort of naive, low-key, old-timey feel to it, which was exactly what... I wanted. I appreciated the minimalism. It was busy without being busy,
mm-hmm.
in a way. And just, you know, it evoked all the cool things about that era. And it was almost like watching a more costumed radio play in a way, the way it was done.
No, exactly.
And the lunacy that was... Richard Jelena and Zach Council and Kate Smith, and having, you know, Al Connors is such a good counterpoint to that, with his, you know, just excruciatingly dapper character going around and trying to not get too much in trouble, you know, like.
And it's very parallel to the film, I found anyways, because you have... It's almost as if that Hannah character is dropped in to the situation, and he, audience identification or reader identification, I guess, even going back, is pretty much instant, because he's making the same sort of wisecracks that you would in that situation if you were caught up in that hole.
Mm.
So it's great. It's fun. And the ability to pull off that, what's essentially a comedy pair vehicle, without having a comedy pair to start from, is risky and hard and works.
And you're talking about Zach Council and Richard Jelena?
Yeah, because, I mean, this was adapted to basically be a vehicle for two English comics. And the structure of it, mm-hmm. obviously,
mm-hmm.
it says that.
It had that feel of the goons,
It's very British comedy special, and mm-hmm. like that border on pantomime, where I guess Al and Kate are your guest stars,
mm-hmm.
but Al's also Ross Petty, so it's kind of awesome.
Well, I think we can all agree that the show is fantastically cast.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. From the get-go. It was 100%. Like, oh my god, this is so well cast that it could possibly fail spectacularly. You were putting an all-star team on the ice. We might not all leave with our limbs. But...
I mean, everybody's talking about the great chemistry between Zach Council and Richard Jelena, which is true. And what great opportunities for both of them to showcase.
They've worked very, very little before. Maybe some Eddie May in that. I buttonholed mm-hmm. Richard, and I'm like, did you two...
You mean like together?
Together. But they look like they were born in the same basket, you know?
But I also think there's great chemistry between Al Connors and Kate Smith.
Totally. Yes, absolutely.
Totally. Oh, yeah. There's no discounting them, because they have to balance all that out.
Yeah.
And carry the narrative.
Yes.
And there is a narrative. Holy God. Oh, look. The show is funny because it actually has a plot. It is a real plot. And you could sit down and you could read it as a short story and be like, hey, that was a plot that I remember now. Because it's mind-blowing, I know, to actually have a through line to a piece on theater, on a stage.
Right.
But, and this is it. This is it. And people are enjoying it. And John Doucette's sets are kind of fun, because they are minimalist functional.
I just want to say, and this is really, really a personal thing, when I watch the show, there's that moment in the play where Zach Council is going with Al through the doors, and he's like running around with his door. 3 years ago, when I directed Patrick Gauthier's 8 Words That Ruined My Relationship, I had a door on casters that I did similar things with, and it was designed by John Doucette. Ah! And I spent that whole scene wondering, is that the door that I actually used myself? But I was like, it was so funny because I was like, oh my god, they're doing doryography, which is like what I coined.
but it's true. No, because I'm thinking of Live from the Belly of a Whale, too, and I'm like, John loves doors, doesn't he? He loves things that open and that change the space in that way by being
Change his last name to Dorset.
Where you extrapolate a space from the things in it. That's fine. Yeah. And it works perfectly because that's that kind of madcapness that you have. Right. A community theater production would build a set that looked like a Laura Ashley bedroom. And you would have all this going on in that Laura Ashley bedroom. You would have these awkwardly painful long transitions where they rolled the entire set off or rolled it back on or painted it red or had a revolving something. Not that that's always a bad thing, but here you don't have to. Here it just travels on at its own pace.
In hands of a lesser team, this could have been a noises off kind of experience, but thankfully it was the right amount of minimalism with the, you know, tempered with the right amount of lunacy.
And what? John Kelly's sense of humor comes through. Absolutely. For sure. This is something that obviously he understands and is well suited for. I'd love to watch a movie with him just based on this.
It actually is one of those productions that makes you wonder how much is in the script, how much is the material, and how much is the team, right? Mm-hmm. Because they all seem to have so much ownership over everything that happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder how much is the adaptation and how much is the...
There's a common, I guess we could say, story or whatever, but when you know, people wait around after shows, and when you don't know what to tell people after having seen a play, oftentimes you'll say, hey, you guys looked like you were having fun. But in this case...
So if you ever hear that...
Yeah, if you ever hear that, just say thank you.
Thank you.
But in this instance, they did actually look like they were all enjoying each other so much on stage. And I mean that in the best possible sense. They looked like they were having fun, that they were enjoying themselves up there, that they enjoyed each other, that they, you know, it was cohesive.
Yeah. And just based on what Andrew was saying about John P. Kelly, I just want to throw in that one night after one of the performances, Crush Improv, which is also Al Connors,
really technically everything is Al Connors.
he may be
eavesdropping right now.
They did a spotlight on John P. Kelly. Mm-hmm. Spotlight on was the format that Crush Improv used at this year's Fringe Festival, where they have a guest monologist tell stories, and then the improvisers do scenes based on those stories. And it was really fun to see one with John P. Kelly on the stage at the Gladstone, on the set for this show. It was an interesting...
It was an interesting dynamic. He's lovely to listen to, and he can tell a story.
Yeah.
And the story is cohesive, and it ends. But it's beautiful. And
so that was fun. Things. And selfishly, I hope that we see more of that kind of thing.
I think that's as valuable as a talkback.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah,
absolutely.
And
it's an interesting
because
fellow.
It's not as processy. Mm-hmm. You know, talkback is processy, and I've heard of the general public going to the talkbacks now and enjoying those. But this is totally different. If you don't necessarily want to hear about the process, hear it drilled to death or whatever.
It's another interesting way of highlighting other people that are involved in the process. Yeah. You know,
it's like the paintings. It's like the paintings at the GCTC. It's where you have an allied form of art that branches off. That's not just inspired by it, but ties in with it.
If I can use that as a segue,
absolutely.
Okay. And true, and I love going to see the artwork to this. to the new GCTC show, Amelia the Girl Who Wants to Fly. I went for the vernissage, so I was there when they had the they showed off the paintings. This is the first time I have seen an artist who, after reading the script, put paintings up in the Fritzi Gallery that I felt actually connected to the show. I found them, albeit quite dark. Yeah. I loved seeing, oh my gosh, here is someone who has actually done artwork based on the script they were given. There's some of the, I'm going to say most, actually, I will permit myself. Most of the artwork I have seen seems a bit like, I read it, I'm inspired by it, and now I'm going to use it as a vehicle for my artistic vision rather than in the spirit in which those
Well, which is okay, because, intended. I mean, not everybody is a realist. Like, Alex McMahon, I hope I got his name right this time. Never mind what I said the last time. Who did the paintings accompanying This Is What Happens Next. I mean, they were very abstract.
Yeah.
They were very, very abstract. But, and he was worried, you know, he's like, well, how is this? And Daniel McIver loved them. Mm. And he saw the relationship, and I mean, it's a very realistic, whimsical play. But and you couldn't guess what's going on by looking at one of the paintings, or at least I can't. Mm. But when you see them both together, it's like, oh yeah, okay, no, I see where you went with this, because this goes back to adaptations. Adaptations and accents are exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. They both follow the same rules, and that is, if you want to get them right, you either have to do them perfectly, exactly carbon copy, or different enough that they are their own thing, right? If you want to do an accent and you can't do an accent, you better overdo it. Overdo it, then it's a bit of comedy, whatever, you know, okay, that's fine. But if you do it halfway, you're going to end up sounding like you lost your accent halfway through. Or if it's a British accent, God knows what sort of crazy train ride it's taking through all of the counties. The same thing with an adaptation. If you do a movie form that is pretty much dead on how the book was, it's never going to be exact. And everybody's going to complain, and people are going to see the movie and not read the book, or have read the book, see the movie, and get pissed off. Because mm-hmm. it wasn't exactly how they thought of it in their heads. Whereas if you do something like Cronenberg did with Naked Lunch, right? It's like, this is an adaptation of a very non-linear work. No, you know what? Now it's William S. Burroughs' life story, and it's a whole bunch of other things rolled into it. And you know what? It's great as an adaptation. Or 39 Steps is not a straight adaptation of the movie. It has a certain highlight, and it goes far enough that it is its own thing. It's the same with redoing Shakespeare. Either you do it canon, you do it, you hold in a Beckettsian way to the text, or you go far enough out that it's great.
So Amelia, the girl who wants to fly,
would be a marked exception to how far it is acceptable to go. You cannot adapt history.
Is it an adaptation of history, or is it its own thing?
Well, it's either revisionism, or it is Aristotle said in the Poetics, basically, oh, it's perfectly acceptable to just write a story and then throw some famous people's names in there so that people pay attention. That's what this is.
There are some interesting things about... I read some people's comments on some of the reviews of this show. And based on these comments, I went and I, you know, like the lazy person I am, just went to Wikipedia and presumed everything would be accurate there.
Every time you hear Wikipedia in relation to Amelia, drink.
But yeah, seriously, great. But there were inconsistencies in the script that you could go to Wikipedia to find that the sister's name is not Midge, it's Pidge. And that it's not her nickname, Amelia's nickname wasn't Millie, it's Mealy. And just little things like that. Oh yeah, but
can you imagine creating songs around that?
Pigeon Mealy, that sounds kind
of... But instead of Midge and Millie, you just do Pidge and Mealy. It's like...
Oh, it's like, this is the... I've been racking my brains trying to think out how the process of this came about. With no disrespect to John Gray. I mean, the man got an Order of Canada for something. And, you know, other great people have gotten Orders of Canada, like Mulroney and Conrad Black and Olive Rush. So they only give them out to the highest caliber of people. And the thing is, you know, do you sit down and do you say, oh, I really want to do something about Amelia Earhart, but I don't really like the fact that she was factually an independent person who made her own decisions, some of which were good, some of which were bad, became an associate editor of Cosmo, and that wasn't just, oh, we're going to give you associate editor of Cosmo because you're popular. No, she was an author, she wrote books, she was as much of a motivational speaker to women of her generation and the future generations as Grace Hopper was, the difference being that, you know, Amelia's last decision didn't turn out well. And that is the consequence of life. That is perhaps a great lesson, is that yes, sometimes you will fail and it won't be your fault. And it's fine, just do it anyway. I mean, things like she decided to do cigarette sponsorships, and she decided to do those things. And George Putnam was not the horrible, unconsciously abusive character that you have here, the guy in the, oh god, no, plus they got the Order of Lovers wrong, jeez, and totally misinterpreted. There it was, not necessarily, although it may have been an open couple relationship, no, it was just a marriage without the iron hand of marriage. That John Gray or whoever tried to put too many things into a play which should have been about one thing. And when you, that can only have happened because you sat down and you said, hey, you know what? There isn't enough here to fill up 2 hours. And as soon as you say there isn't enough to fill up 2 hours with my story, and my story is a historical story, you drop it. You don't say, oh, I better pack this with more stuff. I better have a song about a Mississippi riverboat because this girl was on planes, and a Mississippi riverboat goes with that.
Well,
still angry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you read anything about the creation of this piece, John Gray has admitted he never really had any intention of ever producing it, of ever actually staging it. And it was through the encouragement of a lot of other people.
Particularly director Sarah Phillips, who I can appreciate coming across, especially if you're a John Gray fan.
But this was initially produced at the NAC in the Andeselm years.
Oh, yeah. Right, okay.
Which Patrick Langston noted at that time was reviewed with a fairly unfavorable review at that time as well.
Yeah, so I don't think, it definitely didn't come out of a desire to honor the memory of Amelia Earhart or a real passion for her story. It does seem to be a story about how women can be trapped.
No, it does not seem to be anyone's story. No, I'm not even going to let you say that. It should be. It should be any number of those things, but it is only the first few paragraphs of any of those things.
For a play titled Amelia, the Girl Who Wants to Fly, there was not a lot of focus on Amelia, the girl who wants to fly.
No, and the inclusion of the sister character is what makes me think, you know, there were that was the theme, and obviously by the title, that's the theme, is the desire to be free, but the, you know, constraints of society. Like it's kind of an odd approach.
I mean, like,
and odd to choose Amelia Earhart, but
I would have been completely forgiving of if, you know, the last she sets foot on a plane once and it's the end of the play and everything else is her being on the ground. I mean, that would have, I found, if it was, you know, like,
no, the history because, and things, yeah,
you know, it still would have, I would have found an okay choice. Just to, like, I wanted more of her, and I didn't get a lot of her. I got a lot of the noise around her that was her sister and her husband. Now, I know I probably stand alone on this based on what I think. I liked the actors. I liked the performers. I really enjoyed them. I did notice that I felt that they were working really hard when I saw them on opening night, because I think, or my impression is, they weren't expecting to have as quiet a reaction as they did with the Ottawa audience, because when this was mounted previously, it seemed to have done very, very well based on what I know anecdotally of that. And they seemed to notice that it wasn't the reaction they were looking for. And I felt for them, because I've been there where you work really hard and an audience is quiet. Mm. But, you know, I mean, like, I can't fault any of them for what they've done. I have issues with the directing. I found a lot of it was very cyclical, in as much as people were walking in circles repeatedly because it looked like they hadn't been given direction about what to do.
Whatever happened to exits and entrances?
But there was nowhere to exit from.
Oh, yeah, well, that's true, because it was basically a hockey rink set. You know, it's in the middle of the arena, and built for a much smaller, you know, they could have at least built a new set or taken a saw to that one and spread it apart. Yeah. You've got a stage to work with. Yeah. You don't have to have your whites on all the way through the first two numbers. Yeah. I could feel the whites.
Yeah. There was also, and I noted with the person that I went to see the show with, I found that there was an instrument lacking. It needed more than just piano. And we came up with our impression that for that era, it would have been beautiful if they also had a clarinet player, and it would have rounded out and warmed up.
Funny, I thought you were going to say a klezmer band, basically.
Klezmer band. Why not? Amelia Earhartstein.
Amelia Swing Kids.
Earhartstein. Great. No, but I think an addition of an extra instrument, and for my impression, the clarinet, if it was an extra instrument, it also would have rounded out the sound and the tone a bit more as well. Because I kept looking at the actors and saying, they're wearing those lav mics on their heads. I don't hear any sound boosting from these microphones at all, and it became distracting.
I know, right? Okay, that wasn't just me.
Strange.
That
seems to be a musical theater convention that they need those microphones, and yet
amplification ruins things. I'm with Mammon on that.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, you know what? That would have worked if that would have worked. My fear in April at the season launch. It was April, right? April, something like that. Was that it was going to be Eliza Jane Scott sitting on a ladder, miming with her joystick, and singing about flight. When I got to the show, those were the best parts, and they were surprisingly effective, and they were really great. Or at least the first one was. Everything else is there to kill the momentum.
I'd just like to note, and this is of course
but
no
the
fault.
But the thing is, with one person in a piano, that works. That's how Billy Bishop happened. Basically, right?
Yeah. These three actors with dance routines. I found it interesting in the casting to have Eliza Jane Scott play Amelia Earhart, because I'll be completely honest, Eliza Jane Scott is beautiful, and Amelia Earhart was not. And I found the fact that the lead actress was so attractive a bit distracting, because I knew the historical person was not very appealing at all. She was like kind of a giant rack.
Whoa, hair. Oh, we're going to talk about body image here. Hello. Okay, well, she wasn't necessarily conventional Hollywood attractive, but she had a gap in her teeth.
Have you seen pictures of Amelia Earhart?
She looked like David Letterman wearing a wig.
I googled a ton of Amelia Earhart pictures, and she did look like a skinny David Letterman in a wig.
Yes. Okay.
But I mean, the reason I say that, though, is because that adds to the character and what she struggles, and how her success hinges on the fact that she wasn't conventionally attractive, and to have an attractive woman play that, I think, detracts from what Amelia was able to accomplish not being a starlet-looking woman.
Don't worry, because they didn't go far enough at any point to say that they were trying to make that kind of a point with the play. So you couldn't have put someone who wasn't stunning.
Does that get into historical inaccuracy as well? That
no, that gets into what we'll play on stage, right? You know, we're not showing Ugly Betty, we're showing Amelia.
So if you choose...
She looks enough the part. And Eliza Jane Scott did a very good job of looking plain, which is not her strength. How about that? There's your backhanded compliment of the week.
So if you choose to do a play about a real historical figure, you have a responsibility to make sure it is historically accurate.
Within reason. I went up to Pierre Brault afterwards and I was like, you know what? I suddenly acutely appreciate the amount of research that goes into your historical plays and character work. Mm. And I really do. Because I don't sit down and feel the need to fact check or have done so and say what.
It's right. Like if you write a show about something that's inspired by history, or if you have a character...
We're not going to Godwin ourselves.
Who's not... What?
We're not going to Godwin ourselves. I've already thought of that one. Go on.
Okay, but anyways, so... But I mean, if you have a character in a show who's inspired, that character is inspired by historical events and it's their impression that they take of that, that's one thing. But where you're dealing with representing people who are historical characters and then fictionalizing their impressions of history, that's muddy. And that's this, what I think happened a bit.
This was a show, this ended up being a show about... a fictional character whose name was based on George Patton's, who dealt with some women who were sisters. That's what it was. And it was basically Death of a Publicist. That's what we're calling it, Death of a Publicist.
Probably the biggest thing I struggle with this show is why. Why is this part of the GCTC season? More than feeling angry or upset about the experience I had sitting in that audience, I just thought, how in what way is this a bankable hit for the GCTC?
It's a musical.
I hear some people liked it. And I will have a chance. Knock on wood and make sure that it happens. But I will have a chance to assist with a. An undergrad class that will be discussing Amelia this week, and some of them, from what I understand, liked it a lot. So I'm really interested in hearing their perspective, because I haven't had a chance to speak to those people yet, as in anyone in Ottawa who actually had really good things to say about it.
But I mean, the why first thing it I be thought part of the season. The season is
grab bag.
Well,
oh, Variety. Sorry,
yeah,
misread.
The season is conceived in such a way that it gives the opportunity for a variety of things to be presented. So I don't... It can't not fit, to use a double negative poorly.
Very, very well put. You know, it could have been... I was trepidatious, but the things that I was trepidatious about turned out to be awesome. It was the rest of it that kind of didn't... It fell short of the mark. During the first act, one of the first thoughts I had was, boy, I can't wait to see Whispering Pines. That is where I was.
I'm just always wondering what the choices say about the GCTC audience or about the GCTC itself, like artistic aesthetic of the current
if you have to regime. Wonder then it doesn't say enough. It's like Amelia itself. If you have to wonder what the story is, then it hasn't been told, in my opinion.
So can we agree, not an exciting start to the GCTC season?
Not an auspicious start, which is a shame, because
it is a shame.
I'm sure there's an audience for it that liked it very much.
But again, you know, this is where
it's driving me to get to see Billy Bishop sometimes.
So
why wasn't it Billy Bishop though?
Because Billy Bishop's been done to death.
Has it been done at the GCTC? I mean, if it was about being, because
but we already saw Vimy, and it's basically the same play.
I literally, well, yeah, but I literally heard someone who works for the GCTC say this show will make money for the GCTC, and it was a way of kind of explaining why it's there. So I mean, if that's its purpose, why didn't we get Billy? But like, why, you know, if it's supposed to be the bankable hit, I just don't see this.
Well, you know, it'd be nice Billy Bishop Amelia double bill. Yeah, that would be great. It's like, hey, does everyone want to watch solo aviator plays, musicals by John Gray? Because it's John Gray night at the GCTC.
Billy the girl who wanted to fly.
No, not a mashup.
Okay.
Ah, theatrical mashup.
Yeah.
Great days.
But the rest of the season, there's a lot of focus on let's tell historical stories, mm-hmm. right? So
okay.
They're funny, when I look at the GCTC theme this year, I don't understand why it wasn't built something about like, because that was Third Wall's tagline, engaging the present through the classics,
right,
or something.
Right,
but anyways,
right, yeah.
But something along that line where history now, or I can't obviously can't come up with a tagline, but that they have shows that are focusing on history.
Okay, yeah.
In this, there's Amelia, there's Whispering Pines, there's East of Berlin.
Yep.
That
yep.
You know, it's looking back.
Yeah.
Looking forward by looking back, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. I should come up with taglines for people. I should be a copywriter. You know, I've always thought I was Peggy
Wilson. Let's go into marketing after.
But
people stop.
But you know what I mean?
Podcasts.
Like there's. There is a distinct culture of yearning for the past in the Western world right now. If you look at the success of things like Mad Men, the new TV show that's about the stewardesses from the 60s, a couple of seasons, you have Boardwalk Empire. People are craving that nostalgia, but also to learn about the past, go back. It's a fun way to learn about history. It's interesting. We weren't there for it the first time, so we get to see it now. There's value to going to what happened in the past to reflect on right now, but that also puts a weight on writers that if you are going to go to the past,
it has to be the past.
It has to be the past, and you have to have a clear what you want a contemporary audience to take away from learning about this particular event in time.
Yeah,
right.
But the fundamental reason for that, I think I will put my chips on McLuhan's number here and say that, it is the new media that exists, is the new forms of communication, particularly mobile digital communication, for example, and there is a corresponding retreat of the general population when, not artists, funnily enough. But the general population, when confronted with a new medium like that, there are a certain amount who will go retro, as it were, who will retreat into a previous time because that's safe and that's what they know, even if they don't know it. That's where you get the rise of vintage along with new technologies or extreme futurism. They'll retreat either into a past or into an invented future that doesn't exist, which just mirrors past. Anyways.
So in that way, it explains the having recorded a completely virtual short film last weekend
exactly.
that Andrew and I had worked on versus like the return of burlesque being popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course they come back in new forms colored by the media that have come in between and things like that, which is great because then, you know, eventually looking back, we have some kind of an Earth culture, which is awesome. You know what I'm bummed about is the Third Wall season.
Yeah.
Being, which is a difficult decision, obviously.
Third Wall season being canceled.
Being canceled.
You didn't finish
season. See, I didn't want to finish that sentence. I still can't. That's,
Yeah, no, it's not good for Ottawa theater. It's not good for the GCTC.
It's not good for the GCTC, no. Does not come in a
it's
good
not
time
good
for
anybody who was looking forward to that employment this season that now doesn't have it.
Or to that entertainment. It might be good, but it might be better in the long run, or I think they're thinking of it in that way, for Third Wall. as a regroup.
I think what sometimes people don't understand is how incredibly difficult it is to produce a season. Even if that season is only the three shows, it's a lot. And the economics of theater are very tricky. And Third Wall has been struggling for a few years. And so to continue to commit to an entire season year after year is difficult. We have popular theater companies in this town who don't produce seasons, and there's a reason. There's a reason why Grupo Rubato doesn't do a season. There's a reason why Mikasa doesn't produce a season. Yeah. You know, it's an incredibly taxing thing. Yeah. And
to be fair, in those two examples that you gave, though, their company's devoted exclusively to new work, so they have right. that pleasure of being able to go forward and develop and workshop and then eventually present. When you're a more traditional company like Third Wall and you're doing pre-existing scripts, different story. But I agree.
Would you really?
Is no longer an economy where you can do seasons. And I know having... I'm going to look back almost 10 years ago, but not quite. Say about seven, eight years ago. That I had spoken with other people whose companies were sort of burgeoning at the same time. And they were saying, you know, they would approach me and say, well, how are you ever going to get an audience if you guys never do a season? And I was like, well, we choose not to do a season because we want to focus on developing the work and then putting up, maybe if we have the money, one, you know, strong show a year, every year or every 2 years or something like that, but build on it and not worry about it too much and hope that, you know, the appreciation of the craft and the, you know, enjoyment of the show is going to keep our name at least, maybe not at the forefront, but burbling in your back, in the back of your mind all the time. And, you know, I mean, knock on wood, we've been successful with that. But, I mean, it was a conscious choice that we made to not do seasons. And I think we've benefited by the fact that we sort of had the forethought to realize that this is not a town where you can do season after season of three plays.
And also you're not in existence for the purpose of paying administrators.
No.
Which is pretty much the only reason you need a season.
No. Now I don't...
The reason for the season.
I do not want to denigrate any of the companies, though, that do use the season model, because they're valuable to the city. And it does hurt to see these companies have these issues, obviously. But, you know, when you don't have to rely on subscribers and you don't have to rely on a board and you don't have to rely on all the people who are working in your office and, you know, so on and so forth. And I know Andrew will appreciate this, but like I'm reading the book Theater by David Mamet, and I'm actually at that section of the book where he talks about the subvention of like, you know, subventing artistic goals because there is so much business behind the production.
Subscriber audiences.
Yes, and the nonprofit model and the types of operating funding that are available to theater companies sort of force you in that direction of producing a season.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very old-fashioned model.
It is.
And unless you are a GCTC or an NAC where you are producing in a venue,
yeah.
I don't think it makes sense to produce a season.
Although Gladstone-wise, where you have more than one company getting together and essentially using
the
space.
They're
like roommates.
That's space-related, though.
Yeah.
If you have a space, you need to let people know that there are things happening in that space.
Yeah.
Basic marketing.
But even from the audience, like the audience behaviors have changed. As the theater audience ages, people are no longer, like, new audiences are no longer, they don't have the same desire to have the same habits as people once did. So the subscriber habit is less appealing to people. They want to go to something that is interesting and something that, like, their peers, that other people, maybe even someone in the media, has said is good. You know, they get some kind of a recommendation. So I think it doesn't even necessarily have to be tied to a company name.
Yeah.
It might be tied to a space.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's going to be based on the actual material, the actual show.
Right.
I think an interesting point in the performing arts now, and not just theater, but also things like dance and music, is, like you've said, the way the audience nature is changing, the art forms have to now innovate. but not necessarily in the what they're producing, is you have to innovate in the sense of your business model. And if you don't innovate, you will fall. And this is, like you said, the granting institutions are, I think, now too focused on season-based stuff and how it fits into Canadian content and all these restrictions
just
that are
add
placed
Saskatoon
and placed
berries.
Exactly, but I mean seriously, that these restrictions are placed by the granting institutions on companies, that it's stifling and killing the art form itself.
Right.
You know, no one is going to get a grant if they want to do a Mamet, or if they want to do a new play by someone from Vermont or something. No matter how compelling or relevant it is, no one is going to give you money for that.
That's right.
And we're suffering.
You have to create a company, you have to have all these things in place, right? Or be ad hoc enough that you are a group of artists devising a new piece, because there's like funding for new work and there's funding for organizations.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in between, well, yeah, you better pick it up. Exactly. Well, the thing is not, I guess, I mean, looking at it from an idealistic outside perspective, that you produce and you find a way to produce, which may include grants, but you don't tie yourself to that, because that really is the welfare model. Oh, everybody yeah. gets angry, but no, yeah.
It's true.
Trying what you do to when you can get money to the government is going to buy your groceries on the first of the month, because that's when your check comes in. And I'm not saying, oh, you know, you have to create this wonderful capitalist business model and have real estate and have a pocket full of Mervishes and whatnot. There is that. You do have to balance it out. Maybe it's just in a sense of firing
producing
ahead.
Commercially is incredibly tough.
Exactly.
Rather than completely be dismissive of public funding, I would say it's more important to be more in touch with those administering these funds. Mm-hmm.
There was a really good panel on that that I seemed to vaguely remember.
Communicate more what is happening. Get, you know, I think we still need the public money. It's not going to grow. In fact, it might continue.
Heather Marie here likes to breed pandas. And in the sense that it takes you to push artists and granting organizations together on stage and be like, you know, you can talk to each other without, there is a name here, not just a form.
But there's examples of people who do that, who are then very successful in securing grants and in funding projects that they are passionate about.
There's also a point on the, and I'll play devil's advocate here for a bit on the art side of it, but there is a responsibility as well, and I'm sure they're aware of it, on the granting institutions to really look and reflect on where is this art form going, how are audiences engaging or not engaging with these companies, what is relevant and what's going to keep the art form alive, not necessarily what's always going to be on the bottom political line or what's going to be, you know, what, how let's do it fair, or, you know, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. I know from having spoken to people who work in the slam poetry scene mm-hmm. in Ottawa mm-hmm. that the writing grants that exist through the city, the province, and federally are exceptionally reticent to provide any funding to slam series. They are proven money makers.
Yes.
They are, Canadian slam poets are among the best in the world.
Yes.
We have an unbelievable base of riches in this country of slam poets.
And a huge audience.
They cannot get grants in this city because they'll be told, oh, well, write more about how you will benefit from this and how it will help you. And then they get a response back, and I know this, I've been told this by certain individuals in the city, but they get a response back, you didn't focus enough on how it's going to help your community. So then the next year they say, well, what can I do? They talk to the people. What can I do? Well, focus more on the community. So they said, okay, this is going to build the community this way, and we'll have these people in, and we're going to germinate, and na-na-na-na. You didn't focus enough on how that's going to develop you as an artist. And they shut the door in their face every single time.
Hmm.
And it's unbelievable. And then they say, well, slam poets aren't truly professional because how do you prove that you get paid and make money from this? And it's like, there are people who take off of work and quit their jobs to go and be even more poor than theater artists and tour around the country sleeping on couches and eating ramen noodles for a year so that they can, you know, eventually maybe end up doing some wonderful piece that, you know, can save an Olympic ceremony, you know?
Be, like, yeah. And even I only saw that Olympic ceremony over Twitter, and I still see flying bears in my head, and shame.
Yeah,
those are the two things I'm certain about. No, but the slam poetry, they get bigger audiences than most theater. Sorry to say, but
they do.
Yeah.
But you it's the question period effect. It's like, how the did you fill alumni? But you did. So
it's dynamic.
You better
it's accessible.
Go find out how.
There's, you know, okay, there's plenty of pretension around slam poetry, but at least the audiences go in and you don't get that feeling of alienation from a slam poetry audience like you can get in a theater audience. And I think there's an unfortunate stigma that audience members feel they're coming in and are weighed down with when they go to see theater, that they automatically think, oh, I'm being stigmatized. All these people here know that I don't know what's going on and how can, you know, sort of like go in a bit already scared. Slam poetry, people are like, okay, my friend said I can go here and there's beer. And then it's like, what? I'm going to snap because things are fun or that's cool. And, you know, there's just, it's a different experience.
Yeah. Although I should hope that very few people have that personal persecution aura when they come into a theater, because that's something we're going to have to go and talk to people
about.
How
much more fun would it be if you could go to see a play and no one would think anything of you if someone says something on stage and you're like, yeah, like, that'd be awesome. Yeah. There was actually one of the best experiences I had on stage was when I did Henry V, funny enough, but for the student matinee. When we were doing this scene with Henry going after Catherine, and Michael Mancini started talking to her in French and then like totally like pulled the rug out from under her. And there were 5 teenage boys in the front row who were like, what? Yeah! Freaking out and like high-fiving each other and stuff. And it was amazing.
Right.
Why can we not just let people react like that to theater, you know?
Because theater is participatory, and hello, part of the point of it is that there is a physical interchange. You know, you can smell actors. Think about that. There's an actual physical interchange. There are parts of your body interacting.
I have for
damn,
all...
you're in the same space.
For all of our listeners, I am now going to set a challenge to everybody for the new theater season. And I am a huge loud laugher, and everybody knows it. I want everyone at least once this season to go into a theater, take off your I have to be prim and proper hat, and just let yourself go. Just clap, yell, scream, high five your neighbor, say what, who knows, you know, but just lose
it. Can Heather Marie and I be exempted from that? Because that is us. We are the
if you're already doing it, that's okay. But no, I mean, like, you know.
that is our internal, our inner childs were very well beaten. Yeah. Taught.
I'm serious. Like there was one I saw way back. I saw Enemy of the People at the NAC, and I think it was Tom Rooney at that time was playing the lead. And there's this one section in that play where Ibsen wrote a monologue where he basically says the reason there are people getting sick because the rest of the government in the city, they don't care, they don't blah, blah, blah. I was so moved by him, I actually went, yeah, and I started clapping, and the whole audience in the NAC theater, all this huge, rousing, like, applause, and Tom Rooney just like stopped on stage because he was not anticipating that happening, and it literally turned into it being like a whole bunch of townspeople in a hall applauding this.
But that's what Ibsen wrote it for, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the ones that Emma Goldman takes to task in her anarchist perceptions of theater, whatever the hell it was called. I'm sure I sent you the link at one time.
Oh, wait, I have that. Oh, did I mention I'm working back on that show again?
What?
The Emma Goldman Show that I wanted to write. What? Like, nice. In 2006.
I didn't know this.
Okay.
It's back
up. Okay.
We're going to have to wrap
wrapping
that
up.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
With Tanya's challenge, I think that's a good way to wrap things up. So, thanks as always for being here. Thanks to our listeners, and, you know, keep your ears open because there'll be more of this as the season progresses.
Yep.
So until next time, keep watching theater, folks.
That's right. And buying tickets and stuff.
Yeah.
Tell your friends.
Tell your friends. Yeah, to go see plays. A paying audience is
no,
an
to
awesome
listen
audience.
To the podcast.
And to listen to our podcast. You can also pay to listen to our podcast by randomly giving money to the three of us.
Yeah, we want to.
Just look at Andrew Snowden. He looks like a guy who needs money.
Thanks.
We accept cash or socks.
Yes.
What the?
You can edit that out.
Poor guy doesn't have any socks.